premier pianist from this period, would come to abandon jazz for a career as an academic classical composer, studying under Paul Hindemith, teaching at Yale, and eventually earning a Pulitzer Prize in 1990 for Duplicates, a concerto he wrote for two pianos and orchestra, a piece so far afield from Powell's jazz work as to seem the product of a different person entirely. His charts for Goodman, The Earl, Mission to Moscow, reflect his sound instincts as a big band arranger. But Powell's piano playing stands out as even more suggestive. Technically accomplished, harmonically daring, endlessly inventive, Powell could easily have established himself as one of the most influential jazz pianists of his generation. Instead, only a handful of recordings testify to his potential. Sauter, in contrast, never made the plunge into full-fledged classical composition, but could well have done so. His ambitious charts for Goodman are packed to the brim with activity. His concerto for Cootie Williams, recorded by Goodman as Superman in 1940, is a case in point. Although less well known than Ellington's Concerto for Cootie, Sauter's feature piece for the trumpeter is an equally impressive work with its inspired shifts in key, mood, tempo, and texture. In later years, Sauter pursued a range of commercial projects, including work as an orchestrator for Broadway shows. But his best work, such as his 1961 string writing for Stan Getz's Focus Project, confirms that his personal twist on modern jazz could be breathtaking for all its idiosyncrasies. Who can deny that Sauter and Powell, despite their achievements, represented the way modern jazz did not go, the path steadfastly not taken? In contrast, guitarist Charlie Christian, the other forward-looking musician sponsored by Goodman during this period, would prove to be a leader and instigator of the defining modern style, namely bebop, as it soon would be called. This was not a modernism resonant of Bartok and Hindemith, but one driven by hard-swinging monophonic lines, drenched in chromaticism and executed with lightning speed. Christian's credentials in this regard are all the more remarkable when one considers that his major recordings were made in a period of less than 2 years, and at a point when modern jazz was still in embryo, and most listeners had only the sketchiest context within which to grasp the genius of this soft-spoken pioneer of the electric guitar. To many of his contemporaries, Christian must have seemed more of a novelty act than a harbinger of jazz to come. To this pre-synthesizer generation, electricity was a practical matter, linked with street lamps and lightning rods, not musical performance. Like Hampton and his vibraphone, Christian may not have actually invented his instrument, but he stood out nonetheless as one of its most visionary pioneers, toying with amplified sound at a time when such ventures had the overtones of a grand experiment. Yet Christian's advocacy of the electric guitar represents only the smallest part of his contribution to jazz. With his daring sense of intervallic hijinks, his dancing triplets and swinging 16th notes, his instinct for pouncing on the altered higher notes of the harmony, extracting the maximum amount of emotion from these flatted and sharpened tones, with these weapons at his command, Christian would have been a master at any instrument. His influence on later guitarists can hardly be overestimated. Listen to the small body of performances he left behind, such as 7 Come 11, Flying Home, Breakfast Feud, and the amateur recordings of his sessions with the first generation of beboppers, and hear the melodic material that countless later guitarists would imitate, often borrowing whole phrases note for note, as though these scattered 78s were a textbook on six-string soloing. The first great electric guitarist in jazz, Christian, also demands respect as the most influential. Born in Dallas and raised in the most impoverished section of Oklahoma City, Christian represented a striking contrast to the other modernists, Powell and Sauter, Bartok and Copland, linked with Goodman. Reserved, laconic, largely self-taught, novelist Ralph Ellison, who grew up with the guitarist, recalled him constructing primitive string instruments out of cigar boxes, the willowy Christian would have been easy to ignore if it were not for his stellar musicianship. An impossible rube was reportedly Goodman's first reaction to the guitarist. John Hammond, hearing of Christian through pianist Mary Lou Williams, had flown to Oklahoma City, where he found him playing for $7.50 per week at the Ritz Cafe. Ever the matchmaker, Hammond arranged for Christian to come to California in August 1939 to meet Goodman. The clarinetist's reluctance gave way to rapt admiration after an impromptu jam, lasting almost an hour, on Rose Room. He wasn't the most imposing figure in the world, Goodman recalled some 40 years later. But by gosh, when he sat down to play the guitar, he was something. He was way ahead of his time, and a joy to listen to. Goodman immediately enlisted Christian into his small combo, now enlarged to a sextet. Within weeks, Christian had recorded a number of solos that would be widely emulated by other guitarists, and had performed with Goodman at Carnegie Hall. Jazz fans were quick to take notice, naming Christian as Downbeat Pole winner on guitar for 1939, an honor that would be repeated in 1940 and 1941. But by then his career, though barely begun, was all but over. In the spring of 1940, Christian was diagnosed with tuberculosis. Although advised to cut back on his activities, Christian found it difficult to turn down the growing number of performance opportunities now available to him. In addition to his small combo work with Goodman, he also began playing with a big band, while after hours he frequently joined the jam sessions at Minton's Playhouse, a Harlem nightclub where the bebop style was being refined by a group of forward-looking modernists. But the long hours, the sessions would often last until 4 a.m., combined with the excesses of Christian's lifestyle, served to undermine his already precarious state of health. In July 1941, he was admitted to Seaview Sanitarium on Staten Island. But even there, Christian's situation remained precarious. On March 2, 1942, he died from pneumonia. In the Goodman Band, Christian formed part of a powerhouse rhythm section, with pianist Mel Powell, bassist John Simmons, and either Dave Tough or Sid Catlett on drums. Goodman's 1941 band was the most rhythmically exciting unit the clarinetist ever fronted. "There has never been a rhythm section like it in a white band," John Hammond has asserted. "Without question, it was the best Benny ever had." Catlett's tenure with the band lasted only a few months, but a handful of studio sessions and recorded live dates testify to the impact he had. Big Sid, as he was affectionately known, represented a striking contrast with the Krupa style that had defined the Goodman sound. Supportive, hard-swinging without being overbearing, rock-solid in keeping a tempo, rarely taking a feature solo but showing remarkable melodicism when he did, Catlett was a musician's musician, avoiding the limelight and working in the trenches to kick the band into action. And with what versatility! His two-decade career included gigs with Louis Armstrong, Sidney Bechet, Fletcher Henderson, Duke Ellington, Benny Goodman, Dizzy Gillespie, and Charlie Parker, a whole history of rhythm encompassed in those seven names. These were late vintages of the swing era. On August 1, 1942, recording of jazz music came to a grinding halt as the result of a standoff between James Petrillo, head of the American Federation of Musicians, and the music industry. Petrillo insisted that the union be reimbursed for the increasing substitution of recorded music, in the form of radios, jukeboxes, and phonographs, for live performances. It wasn't until September 1943 that Decca came to terms with Petrillo, with the Columbia and Victor labels waiting for another year before capitulating. But even earlier, the U.S. government, in an effort to conserve raw materials for the war effort, had instituted a 30% reduction in the production of phonograph records. The war impacted the big bands in many other ways. Musicians were conscripted, new woodwind, brass, or percussion instruments became almost impossible to find, and the rationing of gasoline made band tours difficult, if not impossible. In their aggregate effects, these causes did more to put an end to the swing era than the often cited onslaught of bebop music. But swing music also contributed to its own demise. The increasingly formulaic sound of the swing idiom, circa 1942, with only a few exceptional bands maintaining any degree of originality, indicated that this style was at the point of exhaustion as a dominant force in popular music. From this perspective, the rapid rise to prominence of Glenn Miller during these years served as a fitting close to the era. With Miller, the white big band came full circle, back to the ethos of the pre-Goodman period. Relying on catchy melodies, well-crafted if sometimes unambitious charts, and simple dance rhythms, Miller retained only a peripheral attachment to the jazz tradition. Hot solos and expressive soloists, so important to Ellington, Goodman, and Basie, never played a critical role in the Miller style. Miller's frequent reliance on syncopated riff songs, such as Tuxedo Junction, Pennsylvania 6-5000, and In the Mood, marked his one major debt to the swing era. And even here, the riffs employed were always the most facile, the syncopations the most stereotyped. Instead of looking backward, Miller mostly anticipated the popular music of the post-war years, with its sweeter, less frenetic ambience, and its growing separation from the African-American roots that had inspired Goodman and so many of his contemporaries. A decade would pass before the advent of rock and roll would reenact the Palomar phenomenon, tapping the more impassioned energy of the black R&B idiom and bringing it to a mass audience. In the interim, the pop music ethos of Miller and his heirs would reign supreme. Between spring 1939 and September 1942, when Miller joined the U.S. Army Air Force, no band exerted a greater impact on the public's imagination. Moonlight Serenade, a huge hit from 1939, showed how close to the sweet bands Miller was willing to venture. But the singular virtue of Miller's music was its sure instinct for memorable melodic lines. Harkening back to Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata and anticipating a host of pop instrumentals from later years, such as Ebb Tide and Theme from a Summer Place, this trademark Miller effort epitomized his knack for paring down the excesses of swing jazz and returning to the basics of tunesmithing. Simple, catchy, unpretentious, more concerned with novelty than originality, these were the traits Miller would bring to bear in a series of hit recordings, Chattanooga Choo Choo, Pennsylvania 65,000, In the Mood, I've Got a Gal in Kalamazoo, At Last, Tuxedo Junction, and A String of Pearls, among others. Underpinning Miller's success were a variety of instrumental textures that he had refined over the years, especially a velvety brass sound relying heavily on the use of mutes in the large trumpet and trombone sections, and sonorous reed work with its particularly effective use of clarinet, frequently in the lead role. Although jazz fans often carp at Miller's popularity, which to their dismay has proven to be remarkably long-lived, this body of work is not so easily dismissed when dealt with on its own terms. As a jazz artist, Miller was a negligible force, but as a maven of popular music, Miller reached the highest rung. And of all the big band leaders, Miller may have been best equipped, in terms of temperament and style, for meeting the musical tastes of post-war America. But this was not in store for him. After the outbreak of World War II, Miller enlisted in the Army Air Corps, even though at age 38, he would have been exempted from the draft. On December 15, 1944, the band leader's plane disappeared while flying over the English Channel. No wreckage or bodies were ever found. In the absence of hard facts, rumors of all sorts circulated and continue to stir debate decades later. Goodman, for his part, pressed forward with his commitment to modernism in the years following World War II, and though he had made a number of derisive remarks about bebop in the past, he now decided to incorporate many of the elements of the new style into his own music. Did the King of Swing really dare to leave swing behind him? In truth, Goodman's instincts would not allow him to embrace bop wholeheartedly, but he did hire a new crop of artists who managed to adopt progressive mannerisms without veering too far afield from more traditional sounds, such as saxophonists Stan Getz and Wardell Gray, pianists Mary Lou Williams and Jimmy Rolls, and clarinetist Stan Hasselgaard. Yet few were surprised when Goodman's interest in matching the progressive sounds of Woody Herman and Stan Kenton proved to be short-lived. By the time of his 40th birthday in 1949, Goodman had effectively lost interest in following the trends of the younger generation. With his later bands, Goodman maintained a strict allegiance to the swing-era style, supplemented by his ongoing second career in classical music. Except for a 1962 State Department-sponsored tour of the Soviet Union, Goodman rarely ventured into the limelight during the final three decades of his life. He seldom fronted a working band during this period, preferring to hire musicians for short tours or special events. Yet Goodman never let go of his perfectionism and his commitment to musical excellence. He continued to play scales every day before breakfast, striving for improvement even in his mid-70s. On June 13, 1986, Benny Goodman was practicing Mozart when he was felled by a fatal heart attack. Kansas City Jazz. The jazz recordings made during the 1920s and early 1930s provide modern listeners with little indication of the rapid and pervasive geographical spread of the music during those formative decades. Our histories tell us of New Orleans, Chicago, and New York, and little else. But no major urban area in the United States was left untouched by this new paradigm of American vernacular music. Piecing together the full history of this transformation would be a Herculean and perhaps impossible task. Our sources are too few, the subject too large. As it stands, a patchwork of information, drawn from hearsay, anecdotes, newspaper accounts, oral histories, and all too few recordings, conveys only the barest outlines, arbitrary and incomplete, of the broader sweep of this movement. The chance intervention of various record companies saved a few of these regional bands from total obscurity, and even fewer managed to develop national reputations. McKinney's Cotton Pickers was one of these. Formed in Ohio, and later enjoying a long residency in Detroit, this band was admired widely for its solid recordings featuring the arrangements of Don Redman. Such notoriety, however, was the exception rather than the rule. Plying their trade in Miami, Alonzo Ross's Deluxe Syncopators caused little stir in the jazz world, but eight mostly forgotten sides recorded for Victor during a tour to the Midwest reveal a polished and swinging band that, in its day, 1927, would have stood out even in the major centers of jazz. The history of jazz in the Carolinas is typically ignored even by specialists in jazz esoterica, but several ensembles are known to us from scattered recordings. Dave Taylor's Dixie Orchestra, Jimmy Gunn's Dixie Serenaders, the Carolina Cottonpickers, and the Bob Pope Orchestra. The last leaving behind over three dozen sides to indicate its prescient conception of 4/4 swing. In Los Angeles, the studio work of local bands led by Sonny Clay, Curtis Mosby, Paul Howard, and Les Height testify to the rapid spread of the New Orleans style and other influences to the West Coast. A number of St. Louis bands made records, including trumpeter Charlie Creath's Jazzomaniacs, which released 12 bluesy sides in the mid-1920s, the Missourians, and the Jeter Pillars Club Plantation Orchestra. The trumpet tradition was especially vibrant in St. Louis and featured, in addition to Creath, Oliver Cobb, Dewey Jackson, and Harold Shorty Baker, and some years later Miles Davis and Clark Terry. In Memphis, we find Blue Steel and his orchestra. In Milwaukee, we encounter Grant Moore and hear word-of-mouth accounts of never-recorded Eli Rice. In Cincinnati, Jack White. In Omaha, Red Perkins and Nat Towles. No major urban area was without its dance orchestras, and smaller communities hosted the many bands that went on the road. And go on the road they did. Memoirs and biographies of the era are full of accounts of musicians on the move, one-night stands, ephemeral triumphs, and resounding failures in distant cities, or disastrous tours culminating in stranded musicians struggling to earn a fair home. The advent of affordable transportation made such tours possible, while Depression economics made them necessary. As America's infrastructure of asphalt, track, and highway linked up city, town, and village, the nomadic bands of jazz, the modern equivalent of the wandering minstrels of yore, seized the opportunities that this trailblazing offered. Distances of anywhere from several hundred to 1,000 miles from gig to gig were not uncommon for these road warriors. From this institutionalized wanderlust comes the term territory band, signifying the move beyond city limits to wider geographies of these dance orchestras on wheels. The Southwest proved an especially fertile area for territory bands. Texas, with its spread-out geography and relatively large population, offered the greatest opportunity, with developed markets for dance music in Dallas-Fort Worth, Houston, San Antonio, El Paso, Austin, Amarillo, and other cities. With homegrown audiences so plentiful, the Texas bands developed to a high degree in relative isolation from outside influences. The Black Theater Circuit, which brought top-quality African-American musical acts to many other cities, did not reach Texas until the middle 1920s, but traditional and down-home musical styles were pervasive, so much so that a distinctive blend of jazz and country emerged under the name of Western Swing. Its most famous exponent, Bob Wills, made his name in the 1930s with his Fiddle Boys or Light Crust Doughboys before settling on the soon-to-be-famous Texas Playboys. As with Goodman, Wills built his reputation over the radio and parlayed local fame into a national audience, most notably on his 1940 hit New San Antonio Rose, a song that delighted fans with its mixture of big band horns and countrified strings. The impact of the New Orleans diaspora, so decisive in other parts of the country, was less strongly felt in this region. In contrast, the sound of the blues was pervasive in Texas, building on a local oral tradition that had been shaped by Blind Lemon Jefferson, Leadbelly, and Blind Willie Johnson, among others. So-called Texas piano, with its evocation of honky-tonk and boogie-woogie, drew heavily from the blues, as did a legion of later Texas guitarists and singers. And with the rise of larger dance bands, this predilection for the blues again stood out. Gradually, the influence of Redman and the Northeast Arrangers was also felt and incorporated into this grassroots style, and is especially evident in the work of Alfonso Trent, one of the best of the Texas jazz bandleaders of the day. But for most ensembles, an informal head chart style, relying on simple memorized parts, was preferred. Many of these same elements would figure prominently in the Kansas City style as it evolved in the 1920s and 1930s. One need not look far to find the reason for this convergence of styles. Many of the Texas bands, largely forgotten ensembles such as the Troy Floyd Orchestra, the Deluxe Melody Boys, the Happy Black Aces, and Terrence T. Holder and his Dark Clouds of Joy, served as traveling academies for a number of musicians who would later move to Kansas City. Again, economic factors played a key role in drawing many of these performers to Kansas City. A wide-open town with a tolerant, albeit corrupt, city hall, controlled by political boss Tom Pendergast, Kansas City offered a hospitable environment to most of the social vices. And as the histories of New Orleans and Chicago attest, where leisure and whiskey flourished, so typically did jazz. One newspaper columnist, after visiting the city during the Pendergast years, advised his readers, "If you want to see some sin, forget about Paris and go to Kansas City." At the Reno Club, where Count Basie entertained, beer cost 5 cents, scotch ran 15 cents, marijuana sticks sold 3 for a quarter, and a visit upstairs commanded $2. These may seem like small sums, but in aggregate they amounted to big business. A formidable forerunner to Las Vegas, Kansas City boasted gambling revenues of around $100 million per year during this period. In addition, roughly $1 million worth of illicit drugs was sold annually. Figure in prostitution and alcohol and the total impact of the underground economy on the so-called Pendergast prosperity was enormous. As the effects of the Depression ravaged the music communities of other cities in the region, more and more players gravitated to Kansas City to share in the good times. By the middle of the 1930s, Kansas City had emerged as a potential rival to New York and Chicago in its concentration of outstanding jazz talent. But Kansas City jazz was much more than a matter of favorable supply and demand conditions. A distinct style of jazz gradually took root in the city's environs, drawing on disparate elements, the blues tradition of the Southwest, the big band sounds of the Northeast, and the informal jazz session ethos of Harlem. Each of these would be transformed in its Kansas City form. The elaborate orchestrations favored by the New York Arrangers would be pared down, giving way to simpler riff-based charts. These quasi-minimalist textures of Kansas City jazz imparted a looser feeling to the music, allowing even big band performances to retain the hot and ready ethos of the after-hours jam sessions, whose informality of spirit lurked behind, and no doubt inspired, the head charts and written scores. But more than anything, the rhythmic essence of this regional style would set it apart. The two-beat pulse of New Orleans and Chicago would give way to a more modern 4-4 conception of time. Tempos gravitated toward a middle ground, yet this had little to do, as some have suggested, with lower standards of musicianship among KC players. When the occasion so warranted, here for example the Moton Band on Toby, the best of the local ensembles could stoke the fire at a pace well beyond 300 beats per minute, outracing even the fastest jitterbugger on the dance floor. In most settings, however, the ambience of Kansas City jazz life demanded a relaxed swing, with only a subtle undercurrent of urgency. This new sense of time was accompanied by a shift in the nature of the rhythm section, a rejuvenescence that reached its fullest realization in the Count Basie Band of the mid and late 1930s. Gliding over the powerful 4-4 bass lines of Walter Page, drummer Joe Jones was able to adopt a more open sound, relying less on the insistent pulsations of the bass drum, so prominent in the work of earlier jazz percussionists, instead employing his hi-hat as the primal heartbeat of the band. The result was a less staccato sound, a more continuous pulse, a shimmering layer of percussion. Time was now a cresting wave, fluid in its motion, rather than the steady, inevitable ticking of a clock. In this context, the role of the piano also changed, needed to change. Instead of evoking the ground rhythm with a steady four to a bar stride, the keyboard now offered accents, fills, and asides, became one partner in a conversation, not a long-winded orator declaiming first principles. No one filled this new role, that of the comping pianist, better than Count Basie, who stands out as the best-remembered and most beloved of the Kansas City pioneers. In this symbiotic process, Basie, Page, and Jones collectively re-engineered the nature of time and space in the context of jazz, not only putting Kansas City on the map as a major jazz center, but marking a permanent shift in the rhythmic essence of African-American music. Even before Basie arrived in Kansas City, stranded there in 1927 as a member of a touring show, the incipient sounds of that community's distinctive style of jazz were already in the air. Benny Moten, a Kansas City native who had studied piano with two of Scott Joplin's pupils, initiated a decade-long recording career in 1923. In fact, Moten fronted one of the first black jazz bands to record anywhere. From the start, the influence of the blues on Moten's work was pronounced. All eight of the numbers recorded at the band's first session in September 1923 were based on the blues form. Over the next decade, this ensemble would undergo a stunning transformation, shedding the last vestiges of the New Orleans tradition, replacing tuba with string bass, banjo with guitar, growing from a combo into a big band, and absorbing influences from other parts of the country, including the Northeast, where the band visited on tours after signing with the Victor label in 1926. In time, Moten soloists proved capable of matching up with the best of the East Coast ensembles and were especially well served by a strong body of charts, especially those by Eddie Durham, who joined the band in 1929. These captured the loose and easy Kansas City ambience to perfection, mirroring the freewheeling linear movement of the local improvisational style. Moten used the various building blocks to expand the vocabulary of Kansas City jazz, meanwhile serving as mentor to a large group of musicians who would bring this style to greater national attention, most notably Count Basie. By the time of the Moten Band's landmark Victor session from 1932, it was playing at a peak level that few jazz ensembles anywhere could match. This December 13, 1932 visit to the studio produced a number of the most exciting big band tracks of the decade, including classic sides such as Toby, Prince of Wales, The Blue Room, and Moten Swing. Yet these would also be the Moten Band's final recordings. Moten's ensemble had strengthened as he had increasingly attracted talented sidemen from other groups, especially Walter Page's Blue Devils. Originally formed in Kansas City in 1923 as Billy King's Roadshow, the group was on the verge of breaking up in Oklahoma City in 1925 when Page took over the band, renaming it and expanding from 9 to 13 players. Having studied music at the University of Kansas, Page brought a rare degree of polish to the rough-and-ready road bands that he graced. With his excellent sight-reading skills and versatility, he also played saxophone, Page had already taken on the role of musical director even before assuming leadership of the Blue Devils. But it was as a bassist that Page made his greatest impact. Cradling the instrument against his massive body frame, Page weighed in at over 250 pounds. He overpowered the bass, drawing out a stronger, more resonant tone than any of his predecessors. True, the shift away from using tuba or bass saxophone as the harmonic foundation for the jazz band was already well underway before the rise of the Blue Devils. But no one did more than Walter Page to legitimize this change, to assert the primacy of the string bass as the most flexible and expressive voice for the walking line. The story of Basie's initiation into the Blue Devils has often been recounted, never with more flair than in his autobiography, Good Morning Blues. After a late drinking session, Basie made his way back to his Tulsa hotel room, where he fell asleep only to be awakened in late morning by the sounds of a Louis Armstrong record, or so he thought. Groggy and hungover, Yet fascinated by the music, Basie made his way downstairs where the Blue Devils were set up on the back of a truck, performing to a gathered crowd. I just stood there listening and looking because I had never heard anything like that band in my life. There was such a team spirit among those guys, and it came out in the music. And as you stood there looking and listening, you couldn't help wishing that you were a part of it. Everything about them really got to me, and as things worked out, hearing them that day was probably the most important turning point in my musical career. The young pianist soon found himself a member of the Blue Devils, a band that was a magnet for great talent, but incapable of holding on to it. Count Basie, Lester Young, Eddie Durham, Jimmy Rushing, Hot Lips Page, Buster Smith, all of them eventually moved from the Blue Devils to the Benny Moten Band. Even leader Page ultimately made the jump to his more successful competitor. And though the Blue Devils lingered on for some time under Buster Smith's leadership, the premier position in the region had already been usurped by Moten. Under different circumstances, Moten's band would have become established in the history of jazz as the paragon representative of the Kansas City sound. Instead, Moten fell ill during a road trip to Denver, and the doctors advised immediate surgery. Moten did not survive the operation. He was 40 years old at the time of his death. Most of his sidemen eventually found their way into a successor group, led by Count Basie. Born in Red Bank, New Jersey on August 21, 1904, William Count Basie grew up in a distinctly working-class setting. His father served as coachman and caretaker for a local judge, while his mother took in laundry to supplement the family income. The influence of Harlem Stride would predominate in his early musical education, but the youngster's environment exposed him to a wide range of other American vernacular music styles, garnered from player pianos, theater shows, traveling carnivals, and the like. I just wanted to be on the road with a show so much that I would have gone along just to be a water boy for the elephants, if I could. Sometime later, Basie began doing chores for the local motion picture theater proprietor in exchange for free admission to films and live shows. Before long, the adolescent was running the projection booth and filling in for the house pianist. He had already initiated piano studies at home under his mother's insistence, but drums remained Basie's primary musical outlet for some time, until the precocious skills of his friend Sonny Greer, later to achieve fame as drummer with the Ellington Band, convinced him to focus on the keyboard. Basie's father encouraged his son to work with him, mowing lawns and looking after houses on the local estates. But as his piano skills improved, Basie came to realize that a musical career might offer a way out of the menial jobs his parents and peers pursued. Soon, the vibrant nightlife of New York beckoned. Early on, he met James P. Johnson, Willie the Lion Smith, and Fats Waller. Waller was the predominant influence and mentor among this group, as Basie himself later acknowledged. The older Stride master occasionally allowed the youngster to play the house organ during Waller's stint at Harlem's Lincoln Theater, and later helped him get work with a vaudeville act. The impact of the Stride style on Basie's music remained a strong undercurrent throughout his career, despite his more minimalist aesthetic. Well past his 50th birthday, the Count recorded an album, The Kid from Red Bank, on which the two-handed attack of these early models came surprisingly to the fore. But the blues would prove an even more vital source of inspiration for Basie, although not immediately. I hadn't ever really paid attention to the blues, and I hadn't ever played the blues. I hadn't got my first taste of real blues until the burlesque show I first left New York with played in Kansas City. But once transplanted to Kansas City, Basie not only fell increasingly under the sway of the strong local blues piano tradition, exemplified by Pete Johnson and Jay McShann, but in time came to match these masters in articulating an authentic and heartfelt blues style. Yet there was much in Basie's piano style that refuses to be reduced to a discussion of influences. One of the most singular keyboardists in the history of jazz, Basie refined a sparser, more open-sounding approach than any of his predecessors. It was almost as though jazz piano, under Basie's tutelage, stopped shouting and learned to talk, learned to banter and whisper, at times even to hold its tongue in a silence that said more than the most high-flown eloquence. One of the many delights of his music comes from hearing how he could do so much with so little. Incisive, robust, energized, the ends achieved seem at odds with the meager means employed. Some have been tempted to dismiss Basie as a mere tinkler of the ivories, more noteworthy for his band than for his skills as a player. Yet for Basie, a mere tinkle, a simple fill, or the hint of a vamp were rich with implication. These mannerisms became increasingly pronounced late in his career, and at times Basie veered dangerously close to self-parody. But the polish, ingenuity, and veneer of self-deprecating humor that accompanied this music always kept it sounding fresh, even as Basie approached his 80th birthday. Most of all, the complex, note-filled piano attack of the next generation reinforced, if only by contrast, the uniqueness of Count Basie. But Basie, like Ellington and Goodman, would not have reached such a pinnacle of artistry were he not equally a visionary, were it not for his skills of leadership and his ability to motivate others. Starting with a core group of Moton alumni that included Lester Young, Walter Page, Herschel Evans, Buster Smith, and Hot Lips Page, Basie soon enhanced the rhythm section with the addition of Joe Jones and Freddie Green. This was the most supple, the strongest jazz rhythm section of the era. More than this, it prefigured the advances of the next decade when modern jazz would build lavish superstructures on the pared-down landscape cleared away by Basie, Page, Jones, and Green. The simplified left-hand voicings of Bud Powell and the pregnant pauses of a Thelonious Monk, these could only come after Basie had blazed the path, just as the pointillistic drumming of a Kenny Clarke or Max Roach would presuppose a Joe Jones. Much has been made of the influence of the Kansas City tradition on the modern jazz of native son Charlie Parker, but that is only one of the many links between these two schools of jazz. Glimpses of the future are everywhere apparent on the Basie recordings from the 1930s. Even an average soloist would have sounded good with this support, but the Basie band was loaded with talent. Lester Young's genius has been much discussed and analyzed by jazz historians, but he was far from the only star improviser in Basie's horn sections. The contributions of tenor saxophonist Herschel Evans are often obscured by the renown of his celebrated associate, but his powerful sound and rough-hewn phrases, his Texas moan, communicated a visceral excitement few of his contemporaries could match. There can be little doubt that his contrasting style both spurred Lester and set off the latter's more delicate improvisations in sharp relief. The complementary nature of their two approaches can be heard to good effect on performances such as Blue and Sentimental, Doggin' Around, and 1 o'clock Jump. Had Evans lived longer, he died from heart failure in 1939 shortly before his 30th birthday, he would likely have moved out of Young's shadow and established himself as a major tenor voice. Vocalist Jimmy Rushing was primarily a ballad singer when Basie took over the band, but in time he developed a deeply personal approach to the blues. There was a wonderful paradox in Rushing's singing. His resonant voice was a marvel of strength and authority, yet even at his highest energy levels, Rushing somehow retained the clean intonation and heartfelt sensitivity of a balladeer. This happy marriage of the down-home authenticity of the blues with the urbanity of a pop sensibility would set a model for many later Basie singers such as Helen Humes and Joe Williams. Hot Lips Page's exposure to the blues dated back long before his Moton days, when he had worked with Ma Rainey and Bessie Smith. But the influence of Armstrong also loomed large in his playing, and he eventually left Basie to work with Armstrong's manager Joe Glaser in an ill-fated attempt to become a marquee star. Page was one of the hottest players in the band, and his tone and phrasing reveal a sure instinct for the dramatic. Buck Clayton, who replaced Page, offered a more lyrical style, with a burnished tone that was equally at home in the Basie big band or in small combos alongside Billie Holiday, where Clayton contributed some of his most memorable work. The addition of trumpeter Harry Sweets Edison and trombonist Dickie Wells a short time later further enhanced the band's core of soloists, both players distinguished by their direct, conversational approaches to improvisation, set off by impeccable timing. Perhaps the Basie ensemble lacked the arranging and composing genius of an Ellington or the instrumental virtuosity of a Goodman, but as a blowing band, it was without peer. Radio broadcasts and word of mouth soon brought the Basie band to the attention of power brokers in the music industry. A few hardy souls traveled to Kansas City to hear for themselves. In 1936, John Hammond made several visits, his interest excited by a chance hearing of a broadcast performance by the band. Dave Capp of Decca Records soon followed, as did Joe Glaser, who left town with Hotlips Page under contract. Finally, Joe Belford, manager of New York's Roseland Ballroom, made the trek. The combined impact of these visitors from the East bearing homage was soon felt. Hammond set up Basie with booking agent Willard Alexander. Cap signed Basie to the Decca label, and within a few months the band was headlining at Roseland. Even before arriving in New York, Basie undertook a memorable small group session under Hammond's direction in Chicago, recording under the name Jones Smith Incorporated to circumvent the Decca contract. "It was one of the only perfect sessions I ever had," was Hammond's later judgment, and with good reason. Jones, forced to play without a bass drum because of the small size of the studio, reveals his mastery of the hi-hat and snare drum. Basie's style, with its winning offhand aplomb, comes across as almost fully formed. Page's bass lines are executed with metronomic sureness and a tone so full that, on their own, they could swing the whole band. But Lester Young is the real star here. On "O Lady Be Good," he contributes a famous solo, one often memorized and imitated by later generations of jazz players. In its fluidity, clever rhythmic phrasing, and sheer creativity, it stands out as one of the most forward-looking improvisations of the decade. In New York, the band opened its four-week stint at Roseland to mixed reviews. George Simon, writing in Metronome, accused the brass and sax sections of playing out of tune, and even Hammond acknowledged the band's inconsistency in a downbeat review. Growing pains, the result of Basie's quick expansion from 9 to 13 players, may have disrupted the band's cohesion, but the group's problems with staying in tune perhaps owed more to the inferior instruments that many African-American horn players relied on during this period. In any event, the first Decca recordings, made the day after the Roseland engagement ended, showcase a swinging, confident ensemble. During his 2-year relationship with his label, Basie developed many of the memorable blues-tinged compositions that would help define his contribution to the jazz idiom, including 1 o'clock Jump and Good Morning Blues. The addition of Edison, Wells, saxophonist Earl Warren, and trombonist Benny Morton during the Decca years further reinforced the strength of Basie's section and solo work. The contribution of guitarist Freddie Green, another band newcomer, was less noticed by most listeners, but Green's presence served to solidify the already stellar section of Basie, Jones, Page. By the time the Basie Orchestra began making its 1939-40 recording sessions under Hammond's supervision, which produced a series of classic sides including Taxi War Dance, Clap Hands, Here Comes Charlie, and Tickletoe, it had earned growing respect as one of the very best big bands in jazz. The departure of the Basie contingent took place toward the close of the great period of Kansas City jazz. City boss Tom Pendergast's conviction on tax evasion charges in 1939, resulting in a year behind bars in Leavenworth, signaled a move away from the fast and loose attitudes that had fueled the local economy during the Great Depression. Even earlier, as the swing era took off with full force in other locales, many musicians who had come to Kansas City for the opportunities it provided found ready audiences and gainful employment elsewhere. But even in these late days, world-class jazz could still be heard in the city's environs. Bandleader Andy Kirk, who had assumed leadership of Terence T. Holder's Dark Clouds of Joy in 1929, continued to maintain a home base in Kansas City, although his recordings and frequent road trips brought his music to the attention of a wider audience. Until The Real Thing Comes Along proved to be a major 1936 hit for the band, and for a while Kirk boasted even greater box office appeal than Basie. With its poised rhythmic flow and strong blues roots, the 12 Clouds of Joy, as the band was now called under its new leader, was an exemplary exponent of Kansas City jazz and, though its pool of soloists could not quite match Basie's, Kirk had found in pianist and arranger Mary Lou Williams a major talent. Williams had studied piano, composition, and harmony during her formative years in Pittsburgh, but her career in music had to come to something of a standstill after her marriage in the 1920s to John Williams, a saxophonist who worked in the Kirk Band. Since Williams's wife could play a little piano, she was enlisted as a backup for the band's working keyboardist, Marian Jackson. But as her 1930 solo piano recording of Nightlife makes clear, Williams was no amateur, rather a full-fledged keyboard powerhouse with a stirring two-handed attack. Although blessed with perfect pitch, good time, and a sure sense for the blues, Williams was only slowly recognized as a major talent in the male-dominated world of jazz. Women had long been accepted as vocalists, but few had enjoyed successful careers as jazz instrumentalists, and even fewer managed to make records during this period. In 1939, the International Sweethearts of Rhythm, an all-female swing band, would be formed, and after a well-received debut at the Howard Theater, would tour the United States and Europe, as well as record for the Victor label. But their example would stand out as a rare exception. Williams, for her part, gradually rose through the ranks of the Kirk organization. For a time, she acted as chauffeur for the band. She also worked as a hearse driver during this period, eventually securing a spot as a staff writer and full-time performer. But from 1930 until 1942, Williams served as the main catalyst for the Kirk ensemble. Her charts, such as Mary's Idea and Walkin' and Swingin', were marked by a happy mixture of experimentalism and rhythmic urgency, while her playing soon earned her star billing as the Lady Who Swings the Band. In later years, Williams's progressive tendencies became even more pronounced, leading her to adopt much of the bebop vocabulary and inspiring her to compose extended pieces, most notably the Zodiac Suite from 1945. Following her conversion to Catholicism in the 1950s, Williams wrote and performed a number of sacred works and continued to expand her musical horizons long after the age when most artists settle comfortably into a familiar style and repertoire, even collaborating with free jazz titan Cecil Taylor in a controversial meeting of minds. At this Carnegie Hall concert, held 4 years before Williams's death in 1981, two confident masters of the jazz keyboard confronted each other head-on, and neither side blinked. As such daring gestures made clear, none of the Kansas City pioneers brought a broader perspective to their music-making than Mary Lou Williams. But the most influential of the Kansas City players from the 1930s would clearly be Lester Young, who ironically may have been the most introverted, the least focused on inspiring imitators. Redefining the role of the tenor sax was only the first of Young's achievements. In the process, he profoundly changed the essence of melodic improvisation in jazz, offering an alternative to the hot, syncopated style forged by Armstrong and emulated by countless others. The flowering of cool jazz, a supple manner of phrasing across bar lines, a greater sensitivity to intervals such as sixths and ninths not present in the underlying harmonies, the elevation of jazz above hoary clichés borrowed from the New Orleans and Chicago traditions, all of these transformations in the music, changes that would gain momentum in later years, owe a great deal to the foresight of Lester Willis Young. In particular, his small combo recordings, especially those with Billie Holiday, revealed a new facet of jazz, one in which the heated syncopations that had given birth to the music were subsumed in a more delicate chamber music style. But this was much more than an expansion in the techniques of jazz improvisation. In espousing a new aesthetic for jazz, Young also broadened the music's emotional vocabulary, broaching an intimacy and subtle gradations of feeling hitherto unknown to the jazz idiom. Jazz combo style in the 1930s. Born in Woodville, Mississippi on August 27, 1909, and raised in nearby New Orleans, Lester Young came of age in a period marked by an unprecedented blossoming of African-American music in this region. Young may have had some contact with the pioneering hot jazz players who were virtually at his doorstep during these formative years, yet other sources of inspiration, marching bands, minstrel shows, popular songs, apparently made a stronger impression on the child's imagination. In addition, both parents were strict Baptists, and it is likely that Lester heard far more church music than either jazz or blues during his childhood. In truth, there were all too few leisure hours for the youngster to taste the pleasures of New Orleans jazz. Much of Young's early life was spent finding ways to contribute to the family income. Around the age of 5, he began working odd jobs, polishing shoes, distributing handbills, selling newspapers. Even Lester's introduction to performing music was driven by household financial needs. In 1919, Lester's father took a job as leader of a circus band. The son, having studied the rudiments of the violin, trumpet, and drums, was soon enlisted as a sideman in the group. He was only 10 years old at the time. Young's relationship with his father, a stern taskmaster, was stormy at best. Sensitive and shy, Lester Young set a pattern early in life of retreating in the face of conflict. Sometimes this retreat was physical, other times merely psychological. Eccentricities, hip jargon, odd mannerisms, the various bric-a-brac of Young's personality, celebrated by the Beat Generation, were as much self-defense mechanisms as attempts to set a fashionable tone. Several times Young ran away from home during his teenage years, once disappearing for as long as 2 months. Around the time of Lester's 18th birthday, he left again to join Art Bronson's so-called Bostonians, a misnomer given that this territory band worked primarily in Colorado, the Dakotas, Nebraska, and other nearby areas. In 1929, Young returned to the family band, but left again before the close of the year. By this time, he had developed a fair degree of proficiency on the saxophone. He had first started playing the alto sax at age 13, and while with Bronson, settled on the tenor as his main instrument. Over the next few years, Young bounced from job to job, returning briefly to the family band, working for a period with Walter Page's Blue Devils, rejoining the Bostonians, and playing in Minneapolis, New Mexico, and a host of other locales. By 1932, Young had settled down with the Blue Devils, but that group was now in its final days. Walter Page had already left, and Buster Smith stepped in as leader. In late 1933, the Blue Devils disbanded, and Young returned to Kansas City, where he played with many of the local ensembles. Already he was developing a reputation as an outstanding young saxophonist. But the arrival in Kansas City of the Fletcher Henderson Band in December 1933 gave Lester the rare chance of testing his skills face-to-face with the most prominent tenor saxophonist in jazz. Coleman Hawkins was the featured soloist with the Henderson Band, and an after-hours jam session at the Cherry Blossom provided a menu for the visiting celebrity to test his mettle against Kansas City's finest. Mary Lou Williams, who was present that night, later described the scene. Word went round that Hawkins was in the Cherry Blossom, and within about half an hour there were Lester Young, Ben Webster, Herschel Evans, Herman Walder, and one or two unknown tenors piling in the club to blow. Bean didn't know the Casey tenormen were so terrific, and he couldn't get himself together, though he played all morning. Hawkins was in his singlet, taking turns with the Casey men. It seems he had run into something he didn't expect. Lester's style was light, and as I said, it took him maybe 5 choruses to warm up. But then, he would really blow. Then you couldn't handle him on a cutting session. That was how Hawkins got hung up. Yes, Hawkins was king until he met those crazy Kansas City tenormen. At the time of this encounter, Hawkins was on the brink of leaving the Henderson Band, where his replacement would be Lester Young. Despite his jam session success at the Cherry Blossom, Young's stint with Henderson was short-lived and poorly received. Most of the sidemen had wanted Chu Berry, a Hawkins disciple who would later become a star soloist with Cab Calloway, to take over for the departing tenorist. Young's playing was deemed too light, his tone too thin. While Hawkins and many of his followers boasted a vibrato as wide as the lapels on a zoot suit, Young maintained a pellucid tone of almost classical purity. His lines were less rooted to the ground beat, less tied to the underlying harmonies. Such stylistic choices were odd ones in the context of the jazz world of the day, and virtually amounted to heresy in the context of the Fletcher Henderson Band. Henderson's wife went so far as to play Hawkins's records for Young, citing them as examples of how the tenor should sound. Within a few months, Young left the group, returning to Kansas City. For a time, he worked with Andy Kirk, then freelanced with a number of bands, and finally joined Count Basie shortly before the latter's rise to national prominence. Only then, during the closing years of the decade, was Young able to establish his tenor sound as a valid alternative to the Hawkins model. This was no small achievement. During the late 1920s and early 1930s, Hawkins had forged a powerful, full-bodied approach to the tenor saxophone, one that would come to define the mainstream sound of that instrument for years to come. Incorporating elements drawn from Louis Armstrong, Art Tatum, and others, Hawkins constructed a robust, harmonically adept style. The uncertain phrasing and slap-tonguing of his earliest recordings had by now been replaced by a smoother legato, a ponderous tone, and a melodic gift enlivened by Hawkins's mastery of passing chords. Only a few weeks after the stock market crash of 1929, Hawkins participated in a path-breaking interracial session as part of the Mound City Blue Blowers. 1 hour from this date is an especially memorable performance, with Hawkins taking the piece at a much slower tempo than any he had attempted previously on record. The result is a rhapsodic mood piece of the kind that would soon become a trademark of the tenorist. Along with Beiderbecke and Trumbauer's work on Singin' the Blues, 1927, and Louis Armstrong's I Can't Give You Anything But Love, 1929, 1 hour represents a key milestone in the early evolution of the jazz ballad style. Over the next few years, Hawkins would build on this distinctive and influential approach to slow tempos, the process culminating in his iconic 1939 recording of Body and Soul. In contrast to the plaintive style inaugurated by Beiderbecke and Trombauer and taken up by Young, Hawkins offered a more expansive approach to the jazz ballad, implying double time with his intricate constructions. The saxophonist would often fill up each beat in the bar with dense, harmonically charged phrases, employing these Baroque arpeggios as cornerstones for a whole solo. Later in his career, Hawkins would typically use fewer notes in such contexts, but these early forays set a standard with their analytical probing of the popular ballads of the day. In 1932, Fletcher Henderson began advertising his star soloist as the world's greatest tenor saxophonist. It was a fitting title, and Hawkins was no doubt pleased at the recognition. But morale in the Henderson band was low, work was sporadic, and the leader often ineffective or disorganized. Meanwhile, Hawkins was increasingly active in other settings. In 1933, he undertook his first session as leader and also performed on a series of memorable sides with trumpeter Henry Red Allen. The following February, Hawkins participated in an interracial session alongside Benny Goodman and a few days later made his last recording as a member of the Fletcher Henderson Band, ending an 11-year tenure. The final break came when Hawkins was offered the opportunity to perform in England by Jack Hilton, an influential British bandleader and booking agent. Hawkins requested a short leave of absence from the Henderson band. In 1 or 2 months, he promised he would be back. In fact, Hawkins would spend most of the decade overseas and would not see Henderson again for 6 years. From England, Hawkins soon journeyed to the continent, where he played in Holland, Denmark, Switzerland, Norway, and France. Like many American jazz musicians before and since, Hawkins enjoyed the tolerant and receptive attitude of the European audiences. On his arrival in Copenhagen, 5,000 fans gathered at the railway station to greet him. A few of them carried Hawkins, who was seated on an ornate chair, to his waiting taxi. A similar entourage awaited his arrival in Oslo, where Hawkins was presented with flowers, and young ladies struggled to get a glimpse of the visiting celebrity. In England, the periodical Melody Maker, which had long lavished praise on Hawkins, enlisted him to contribute 3 articles outlining the secrets of his jazz saxophone method. While working in Switzerland, he learned to ski and toyed with the idea of becoming a vocalist. Some 15 years had elapsed since James Reese Europe, Will Marion Cook, and Sidney Bechet had brought the sounds of hot African-American music overseas. In the interim, the European audience for jazz had grown more sophisticated, more fanatical. Around the time of Hawkins' arrival, a coterie of ardent supporters, Hughes Panisi, Charles Delaunay, Robert Goffin, and others, were taking the lead on a variety of fronts to promote jazz music on the continent. Their activities extended to founding Le Jazz Hot, often cited as the first jazz magazine, although Sweden's Orkesterjournalen predated it by 2 years, which made its debut only a few weeks after Hawkins arrived in Paris. The first issue was printed on the back of a program for Hawkins's concert at Salle Pleyel, as well as to establishing venues for performance, producing recordings, undertaking historical and discographical research, and exhorting their contemporaries to treat jazz seriously as an art form. Their efforts would shape the European taste for jazz and eventually be felt back in the United States. But European participation in the jazz world was no longer merely as a passive, if receptive, audience. As Hawkins soon saw, European jazz musicians had made enormous strides by the mid-1930s. Although the vast majority were little more than imitators of models from America, a few artists of the highest order were drawing on local traditions and fusing them with jazz to create vibrant new hybrids. Of these pioneers of European jazz, the Quintet du Hot Club de France, featuring guitarist Django Reinhardt and violinist Stefan Grappelli, had attained an especially rare degree of inspiration, establishing itself as one of the most important jazz groups of the day. The band's instrumentation revealed a fresh break with the traditions of American jazz. In place of the brass, reed, and percussion elements so prominent in African-American music, the quintet employed a violin, 3 guitars, and bass. But the distinctive character of this group went beyond its reliance on strings instead of horns. Reinhardt and Grappelli brought a specifically European perspective, drawing on gypsy music, classical composition, and local folk traditions to bear on their jazz work. The band's repertoire was drawn from disparate sources. A swing version of a Bach concerto movement or a bolero inspired by Ravel might be juxtaposed with pop compositions by George Gershwin or Noel Coward, or coexist alongside a New Orleans warhorse such as Tiger Rag. This was music that respected no national boundaries, as nomadic as Reinhardt's gypsy forebears. The cross-cultural roots of the quintet were also felt in the style of improvisation, especially Reinhardt's. With a fresh lyricism, he cut through the clichés of early American jazz guitar, discarding the banjo-inspired syncopations and ponderous rhythms in favor of a more fluid approach, one that was both melodically inventive and rhythmically inspired. Grappelli, for his part, thrived in this context, but this artist demonstrated, in later decades, that his violin could adapt to almost any type of setting, jazz or otherwise.